Oh, cheeky, cheeky. Oh, naughty, sneaky. You're so perceptive, and I wonder how you knew.
But these things don't work too well. A bad sense of direction, and so they stumble.
Chicken. Can those poor teeth take so much kicking? You're always so charming.
As you peck your way up there.
And these pigs don't dress too well.
Do you prefer Matt or Matthew?
It doesn't matter.
It's interchangeable.
People on the West Coast used to call me Matt.
We're very informal.
Maybe you should call me Matt.
Okay. I'll stick with Matt. Now, you're from the West Coast, right?
Yep. I'm from Lummi Island, Washington, which is just off of Bellingham.
Oh. So not very far from Vancouver at all.
No, yeah, Vancouver was closer than Seattle, and people would go to Vancouver from Bellingham to drink when they're underage.
Oh, because of the 19 instead of 21.
The 19 law. Yeah, and I used to get Canadian TV and watch CBC. Watch, like, The Droids.
Oh, God bless The Droids. Sunday mornings.
And Littlest Hobo.
Yes. The only the finest in Canadian cinema. I guess it's not cinema.
Degrassi High. Degrassi Junior High.
Well, lots of Americans love Degrassi. It's got a substantial odd following.
It's right, it sort of broke out of the... I don't know. It was too good to be constrained just to Canada.
The irony is the neighborhood that the show is based in, like Degrassi Street, you go to Toronto, and it's the crappiest neighborhood.
Oh.
it's like calling, like, you know, 90210, calling it Compton High or something. It's...
It was. Wow.
I walked by. I was just checking it out. You know, I'm in Toronto. Oh, Degrassi. Oh, look, Degrassi Street. Oh, look, I can buy drugs.
All those kids just became lowlifes and street thugs.
Well, the one did get knocked up, so that's a surefire sign. So, when did you first get into comics?
Well. When I was a kid, I liked comics. And when I was in high school, I would draw comics with my friends at late night diners and things. Like, we'd pass pages around, and each of us would draw a panel. So, I don't know. I did a comic when I was 12 called The Killer Pigs Target USA. That was a science fiction comic.
I kind of think that would fit in with some of the topics of your comics you have going right now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'll reprint it.
Add it into the 1-800-MICE collection?
Yeah, I mean, anthropomorphic, you know, talking animals.
Mm-hmm.
This is, like, highly indebted to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, so everybody, all the pigs from outer space had headbands, and they carried machine guns, and they invaded San Francisco. For some reason, I thought that would be, like, a good place. I think it was also inspired by V,
mm-hmm.
that TV series.
With the lizards. The lizard aliens.
Reptilians. Sorry.
That's okay. You're in New York, right?
Yes.
There.
It's like a field recording. There's, like...
At some time, you know, you'll...
Atmospheric sound effects.
At some point, you'll start playing the banjo. Oh, wait, you play the ukulele, that's right.
I didn't bring one with me.
Okay.
I'm in transit. I'm walking past the graveyard right now.
Okay. So what kind of comics were you into other than Ninja Turtles growing up? What was spiking your interest?
Well, I really liked ElfQuest. Something about it was great. I don't know. I liked the warfare and the maybe the mysticism and the adult tone. The elf orgies were a highlight in the fourth collected volume, I think. There's a big... Or maybe the third. I don't know. I like that, and I like Batman, Superman. Weird, like, 90s... 90s, you know, independent efforts.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. The Desert Peach. Just weird things that you'd find in the comic book store.
Mm-hmm. Well, Donna Barr, she's not very far from where you were from.
Yeah, she was like, I don't know. I guess she was around somewhere. You'd see, like, little posters for her,
mm-hmm.
doing a signing. I never really read it continuously, but I don't know. I would just try out various things, try reading things. And I got Raw when I was in... Or, like, the first year of high school or something, and I really loved it.
That's a good age.
Yeah, I don't know. It just coinciding with, like, discovery of a lot of things, like, around 13 or 15, like, the Rocky Horror Picture Show and, you know, Eraserhead and Monty Python and David Lynch and all this kind of subcultural stuff and music.
So was Raw your kind of reference of where comics could go after reading Ninja Turtles? Did that kind of set something apart for you?
Yeah, I don't know. It definitely, it was, I guess the highfalutin literary aspect to it I thought was really awesome, and I don't know, like, I got the Raw book with Gary Panter's sketchbook pages in,
mm-hmm.
with these weird captions that seemed disjointed from the drawings, but to, like, give them new meaning in a way, and those particularly, like, really stuck with me. I don't know, maybe, like, the evolving of comics into more, like, art or I don't know, just the fracturing of it or something.
Deconstructing?
Yeah, I don't know. There were a lot of deconstructionist comics, I guess, in Raw, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They were, like, really into taking apart the language of it. And, so yeah, I guess that was, like, a touchstone or something.
What kind of, did you do any art schooling?
Yeah, I moved out to New York to go to art school at the Cooper Union, which is, like, a small school, and it's really, so I moved out here in 96. It's sort of conceptually heavy, and I don't know. I guess I was trying a lot of different things when I got there.
What was your artistic intentions when you started there? Like, did you go, I want to make comics, or was it you wanted to work on something else, and comics just kind of evolved out of that?
Well, I'd already done a lot of writing and drawing and comics, and when I was in school, I mean, I tried, you know, all stuff that I hadn't got a clue about how to do, but I kept on coming back to sort of narrative-based projects. Like, I ended up doing an animation as my graduating project, which was about this architect who got shot named Stanford White. And it was, I guess I was interested in history and history stories and sort of revisionist history, like making up your own version of something that actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of surreal quality of that, like taking a real event or a real person's life and reimagining it.
Just adding in, like, absurdist elements and...
Yeah, or just, like, thinking about what it meant, like, what the trajectory of human life meant. And so, yeah, I did this... I don't know, I did lots of different things. Like, I started doing, like, scroll drawings there that were, like, long comic strips, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And I would unroll the scroll, and I don't know, animation's great, and I've done, like, little animation projects over the years, but I don't know, yeah, school was just, like, trying everything out, realizing, like, oh, I'm not a very good sculptor, things like that.
Now,
but...
Did you, like, I'm not familiar with your oh, we're getting a big windstorm there. I'm not familiar with your stuff from before Picture Box. Were you doing, like, small press mini comics type of thing, or?
Yeah, I did, only starting in 2000, like, after I got out of school, I just started doing mini comics and, like, sending them to USS Catastrophe or, you know, local New York distributors,
mm-hmm.
and bookstores. And I did a series. It wasn't really a series. It was just like two comics, but called Mining the Moon, which was kind of a fantasy comic, and one with my girlfriend Rebecca called Easter Special, and I don't know, just lots of little sort of drawing book kind of things that weren't necessarily narrative, but semi-narrative.
Kind of in the Mark Bell school of things.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess I found out, you know, about Mark's stuff, and Ron Rigi and the Fort Thunder people and all that around 99 or 2000, and I don't know. I had a friend who was living in Boston, this guy Alika Harishoff, and he showed me, you know, Paper Rad, and I don't know, he was a member of Dear Raindrop, so he was doing art with them, and I got exposed to all that at the same time that I was like coming out of school and like really going like, wow, you know, I love Tony Millionaire and like all this like all this comic stuff is like really interesting.
So did it change what you kind of had in mind as far as what you could do with comics?
Maybe that particularly crazy art stuff did. But I feel like I had sort of my own goals of narrative confusion or like Baroque kind of storytelling,
mm-hmm.
in mind, and then maybe it was just more seeing that there was like a lot going on in drawing and do it yourself kind of publishing culture. Like because I did a zine, you know, I liked sort of the zine level of things in high school, and then college was so I don't know, oriented towards gallery art, mm-hmm. museum art, and then it was like, whoa, okay, there's this like awesome subcultural stuff happening.
Are getting published by Pitcher Box?
Let me see. In 2004, in one of the Gonfelds, Gonfeld 4,
mm-hmm.
I had like a 5-page story
that was
in there. And, yeah.
That was the story of the silkworm?
Yeah.
What was the interest?
The first.
What was the interest with the silkworm?
What was the interest?
Yeah, in the silkworm. Yeah.
I guess that story. I was trying to create like a system of a narrative system where everything would be tied together.
Yeah.
Through the like the physical elements of what was in the story. So the balloons being made of silk, and the silkworms that live on this island, and the death and the reincarnation of the balloon racers. Like, I wanted it all to tie together.
All kind of interconnected environment.
Yeah, I don't know. There's like a play in the inside the story where the silkworms have their own kind of mythology, and I wanted that to echo the larger mythology in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Whoops, I'm trying to get onto a quiet walk. Sorry. I thought I would like walk to the subway and talk. I should go on a side street or go in a community garden or something.
Where in New York are you?
I'm on Fifth Avenue and 20th Street.
Right in the middle of Manhattan?
No, I'm in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
There's a big moon out tonight.
Oh, yeah, it's dark out there. See, it's the middle of the afternoon here. I was out in a t-shirt a couple minutes ago.
Oh, wow. Soon you'll see the moon. We'll be here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure. The coming of fall. Now, one thing that strikes me about your work, with that story, with the silkworms and the 1-800 mice, is your love of nature, or the use of nature. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yeah, like a concern about nature.
Was that a big part of growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in like a pretty rural environment.
Mm-hmm.
And on this island, and there were a lot of trees and woods, and you would go play in the woods with your friends and play on the beach. And I don't know, I feel like environmental concerns are sort of this backstory to a lot of the comics that I've done, but trying to pitch it in a different way, in a different light or something. Like, I mean, there's disturbing news about the environment, but, you know, how do you sort of make a comic about it without whining or complaining or saying, like, save the trees or something? So in 1-800 Mice, somebody suggested, I don't know if he even remembers, but that I make trees into characters. So I kind of did, and had them be the sort of the major players in this. It's sort of like an idea of a city where the trees are like have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know.
What was your idea when you started 1-800 Mice? Like the overall intention, I guess.
Well, I guess I was, let me see, thinking about soap operas and, like, EastEnders. I remember watching some episodes of some TV shows and thinking about, like, doing a story about a city, like a controlled environment where there were a lot of characters, but they'd intersect, and you'd get the idea of the city through the interactions, like the same way that you watch a soap opera, and like it keeps on cutting back and forth between all these different characters, and you get a sense of the place that they're in. So I wanted to have a city that was kind of like crazy New York sort of city, and like a really overwhelming urban environment.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's about it.
Well, I was going to say, that's the feeling I get from reading it, is that it just seems so, there's so much to it. Like, and it all, they don't all immediately connect, all the characters and stories. And I'm just, like, curious how far this is going to go.
Well, I mean, I sort of set it up to go infinitely far. And I think that a lot of what I've done in comics is just sort of begin stories all the time, so I can sort of have this stock of, like, characters and situations that I can keep on reassembling.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the first issue, it's just a ton of different little subplots that, you know, eventually they'll all sort of meander together. And, I mean, I have this loose script of where everything's going to go, but it's also, like, gives me room for thousands of digressions, which is, like, I don't know, that's just what I like about, I mean, you know, there's novelists or something that the manuscript found in Sargossa is a good example. It's just like this Polish author, and it's just like a story within a story within a story, and it keeps on going. And I don't know. I think it's just great. It's like, if you have enough sort of an arsenal of characters and situations.
It's almost like classical Russian literature.
Well, I haven't read that much of that stuff, unfortunately. But probably, I mean, yeah, it's just setting up like an epic scale, or setting up like an ecosystem or something.
Mm-hmm. I think ecosystem is a better term than epic scale.
Yeah, I don't know. I wanted it to have an organic feeling, and like other people have done this to great effect, like the Dan Clowes 8-Ball story. I really like that's like a
the Ice Haven one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I Brian Chippendale's stuff. That's also kind of got this multitude feeling, and I don't know, and Mark Bell's stuff, where there's just like layers of different sizes of characters almost that are all infesting each other's living quarters, and I don't know, it just feels really alive.
It's very like infinite, like especially like I totally see that comparison between the Mark Bell world of the different layers of characters and the different levels and the sizes. That's definitely a very good analogy.
I don't know. I mean, it's also very, like, a hubristic thing to do. You know, to, like, I'm going to build an infinite world and replace the world that I'm living in, this one that I'm designing. But, I mean, it's also just, like, it's a lot of fun.
We're getting sounded out. Sorry, the wind's getting us.
Sorry. Yeah, if you go in this coffee store, this carpet store. Yeah, so, I don't know, infinity is good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Thinking about your environment, everything that can happen, daydreaming about it. I don't know, gaining some control over your environment, maybe. Or you feel like if you live in a city, you're just totally confused all the time and getting lost.
Yeah.
Instead, you can take the power back.
When can we see the next, part in the ongoing 1-800-MICE world?
Well, let me see. I'm working on a book for Picture Box, and I have enough material for another issue now, and I'm sort of thinking that maybe I should keep putting out the issues in some way so it doesn't get forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like it could be a while before the sort of book comes out. And I don't know, just at the pace that I've been working, been doing tons of other stuff on the side. So yeah, I don't know, maybe I'll put out another issue in sort of a mini comic way, but probably soon.
What's the book you're doing with Picture Box?
Oh, just the 1-800-MICE comics, I guess, haven't been terribly profitable. So Dan and I thought that the best solution would be to just put it out when a book was ready.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that sounded good, but then, you know, a year later, I'm like, well, I only have, you know, 20 more pages, and this is going to take forever. And I like the feeling of releasing things.
Yeah.
Like, all the time, I feel like that's, like, one of the best things about comics is this, like...
Holding it?
You know, holding it and just giving it out to people and getting, like, trading and seeing what somebody's been doing lately and having something not very precious, you know, to just keep mm-hmm. giving out. Rather than sort of this weird state that I feel like graphic novels are putting people into, where it's like, just hole up and work on your book and, you know, 2 years later, like, somebody's book comes out. I don't know. I just like the more, like, you know, assembly line, you know, just churning out stuff as fast as you can.
Well, there's something to be said about the development of interacting when you produce something and you kind of get your peers' point of view on it. You get, you know, reader reaction that you're not going to get when you're in this sedentary graphic novel mode where the next time we'll see you is 500 pages later.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's, you know, Sammy Harkham wrote a great article about it in the last comics, like, why the pamphlet form is important, and, you know, Frank Santoro is a true believer in comic pamphlets, and I don't know, I just think the self-publishing wing is more important than, to me, than this graphic novel industry that a lot of, you know, that seems to be offering more cash to creators, maybe.
It's why
we can get a book deal, but it's also like it's like abdicating some of your own do-it-yourself power.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know, but then at the same time, it's hard to do it yourself, and it's hard to pay to put out comics. So what are you gonna do?
I love mice. Mice are my brothers. Mice never bother me. Sitting at my tea, I throw them half of what I'm eating. Rats are a different kettle of fish. Faces ain't so friendly. When they eat you in the night, you do not want to know. And they smell very, very strange. and they smell very, very strange. And they smell very, very strange. And they smell very, very strange.
Well, that kind of brings me up to, you know, the latest, I guess, Mammoth Publishing adventure is your part, or you're in part of it, the Kramer's Ergot 7. Tell me about what you had in mind for that story and how it kind of developed into the Land of Eno.
Well, let me see. I did a mini comic called What Kind of Magic Spell to Use a couple of years ago that probably was the origins of this story.
Did you play a lot of Dungeons & Dragons?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was the Dungeon Master. I had... Oh, man. Yeah. I had all those books.
That's another...
I played with the same nerdy friends that you know... are still, like, you know, my closest friends. And we, you know, the same people we did comics together and also made movies and things like that. But, so, yeah, so I did this comic about David Bowie recording the Labyrinth soundtrack in, like, a completely make-believe way.
Mm-hmm.
And with, like, in the comic, he has to record it with the actual creatures from the movie Labyrinth. and like, Steve Albini is called in to produce the album. And then, you know, it was kind of making fun of David Bowie, who I love, you know, but it was fun to draw him. And then it was kind of making fun or thinking about the idea of what is producing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this weird idea is of, you know, hovering over, like, I don't know, being like sort of a shaman or something.
Yeah.
So at the end of the book, they're like, we've got to get Brian Eno to produce the Labyrinth album, and David Bowie goes out into the woods and, like, summons Brian Eno. So then the Kramer story is kind of like a follow up to that, because I never did a second issue of that mini comic.
That mini sounds, like, fantastic.
I don't know. I don't know if it's... Well, people seem to like it.
I'm a big Bowie fan, so I'm always happy to see something fun done with Bowie.
Yeah, well, it's just a tribute to him and Brian Eno and this sort of magical... You know, they're particularly the albums they did together, and Brian Eno's early albums are, like, really magical to me.
Mm-hmm.
So then the Kramer story is just, like, I don't know, following up with Brian Eno. It was, like, 10 years after the death of Michael Hutchins.
Oh, okay.
And, so it's, like, about Brian Eno being summoned to go into the underworld to produce the next INXS album after the death of, like, he has to record it with the sort of corpse of Michael Hutchins, or the zombie of Michael Hutchins. So, I don't know, it's kind of like pop culture mythology.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even realize the Michael Hutchins part when I was reading it, and now I'm looking at it with the birds and the choking him. Is that him getting choked? And the hanging and the droop. Beautiful.
Well, the parrots are based on this cemetery that I just walked past in Brooklyn, and they live there. There's these wild parrots that live in Greenwood Cemetery. So... kind of thinking of them as the guardians to the underworld, and how they actually brought Michael Hutchins down to the land of the dead to record this album for the King of the Parrots. And then, yeah, and then he has to, like, get the best producer possible, so he gets Brian Eno. And, I don't know, I guess just mythology and stuff is kind of a real interest of mine.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fantastic, and I quite enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
Now, do you have anything else coming out soon that people may be able to get their grubby hands on?
Let me see. I'm doing a book on tape. Should come out soon. And
a book on tape.
Yeah, just
like a reading.
Second one I've done is like a story with sound effects. I don't know. I'm starting a book on tape label, cassette label. So that should be out soon. It's called Sherlock Holmes and the Large Door, and it's a Sherlock Holmes story, mystery story. And there's other stuff. There's like anthologies in the works. I guess I'm in the Yale anthology.
Oh, I didn't even think to look at it. I've got a copy at home. I should have looked to see if you were in there. My bad.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a reprint of the story from the Gonsfeld.
Oh, okay.
And there's other anthologies. I don't know. There's one called The Lifted Brow from Australia. That seems pretty neat. It was like hundreds of different creators were given a title to a fake book to illustrate. So just have a short story in there. And yeah, I don't know.
That sounds fantastic.
All I can think of right now.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your evening to join us walking the scary streets of Brooklyn.
Ooh, so spooky.
Do you have to watch out for hipsters in your neighborhood?
Yeah, Mexican skateboarders.
Uh-oh.
And people eating corn on the cob. Yeah, I mean, thanks so much for talking to me. It was fun.
And if you can do one favor for me, send me an email with 4 song requests.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me, Matt.
All right, Robin.
And I hope you have a swell evening.
You too.
Okay.
Have a good night.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Bye.
That was Matt Thurber, and we were yakking about his comics. Check out 1-800-MICE as well. He is in the new Kramer's Ergot, like I mentioned, and Picture Box is his main publisher, so check those folks out as well. See y'all later.
Frog went a-courtin' and he did ride. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o, with a sword and a pistol by his side. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o, kimey-o-kimey-o-kimey-o, way down yonder in a holler tree, an owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o. He rode till he came to Miss Mouse's door. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o, and there he knelt up on the floor. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o, kimey-o-kimey-o-kimey-o, way down yonder in a holler tree, an owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o. He took Miss Mouse up on his knee. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o, and he said, little mouse, will you marry me? King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o, kimey-o-kimey-o-kimey-o-kimey-o, way down yonder in a holler tree, an owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy-kitchy-kimey-o. Miss Mouse had suitors three or four. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. And there they came right in the door. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Ki, mo, ki, mo, ki, mo, ki. Away down yonder in a holler tree. An owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. They grabbed Mr. Frog and began to fight. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. In that holler tree, twas a terrible night. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Ki, mo, ki, mo, ki, mo, ki. Away down yonder in a holler tree. An owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Mr. Frog hurled the suitors to the floor. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. With his sword and his pistol, he killed all four. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Ki, mo, ki, mo, ki, mo, ki. Away down yonder in a holler tree. An owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. They went to the parson the very next day. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. And left on their honeymoon right away. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Ki, mo, ki, mo, ki, mo, ki. Away down yonder in a holler tree. An owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Now they live far off in a holler tree. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Where they now have wealth and children free. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo. Ki, mo, ki, mo, ki, mo, ki. Away down yonder in a holler tree. An owl and a bat and a bumblebee. King Kong, kitchy, kitchy, ki, me, yo.